Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. We're so glad to have you with us here this evening on Ask Herbal Health Expert Susan Weed, a two-hour radio show each Tuesday night. Herbal medicine is people's medicine, simple, safe, effective. Please bring your curiosity and health questions. Susan will enlighten, surprise, and delight you. I know most of you know Susan Weed already. She's my mom, so I know her. But for those of you who have not yet met Susan, I'd like to share. She is the author of the Wise Woman Herbal series, wonderful books on women's health and herbal medicine, including Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year, Breast Cancer, Breast Health! The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Wise Woman Herbal, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way.
And Abundantly Well, Seven Medicines, The Wise Woman Way, the newest book in the Wise Woman Herbal series.
So exciting.
In addition to being the editor at Ash Tree Publishing and writing her books, Susan is the director of the Wise Woman Center in Woodstock, New York. The Wise Woman Center is open to the public on appointment-only basis. She offers weekend workshops, intensives, and apprenticeships throughout the season. Susan is also available to you online via wisewomanmentor.com. There you can go and view her weekly e-zine. You can subscribe to receive a notification via email each week, or you could join her mentorship program. Susan also offers distance learning correspondence courses and online courses.
TheWiseWomanSchool.com. Join us there for colorful, instructive, easy video courses, including Easy Herbal Medicine with Susan Weed, Happy Knees, a cancer diagnosis, adaptogens for long life, and Abundantly Well companion course, wisewomanschool.com.
You can also just go to her website, susanweed.com, where you will find thousands of pages online with recipes, articles, art features, and so much more. Well, for now, let's see what Susan has to share with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Justine, and welcome, Sarah Ellen.
Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
Oh, very well. Did you see the eclipse?
I did. I got up early, a little bit earlier than usual, and saw most of it this morning. Yes.
How exciting. I think you're a little bit west of me, I think you're a little bit west of me, so I think you might have gotten to see a little more of it. I woke up just as the first bite was being taken out of the moon, and then I went and stood in the shower, because I knew otherwise I'd just fall asleep, because it takes a while. And it was, you know, it was really like a bright, full moon. When I went into the shower, when I got out of the shower, it was dark. And all the stars were out. And then it got down to the last little sliver of the moon, and the sky started to lighten with dawn.
Wow.
So we didn't quite get the end of it. I, of course, just, you know, went to the internet and said, who's live streaming the eclipse? And there, of course, was somebody with a telescope set up that was live streaming what was happening, so I got to see it. The last little bit wink out.
Very nice. Yeah, we did the sun rose here just as it was about three quarters of the way out of the shadow. So I got to see most of it.
Very exciting. And we have been having light frosts, and the poke has gotten kind of brown, but it's still kind of standing up. How's yours doing?
We were talking
about it last week and how it just kind of crumples to the ground, and it's not doing that this year because we haven't really had what we call a killing frost.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, ours are still standing tall. Some of the berries are looking a little more sad and heavy where they're hanging. But, yeah, they're still standing. But on Friday, we're going down to the 20s and staying in the 20s and
30s.
So. Yes. It's really a rough
Yes, that will be the hard frost. That will be the one, the killing frost. And then then things will be different with the plants. And with us. So what are you up to? We are making applesauce and apple butter and apple cider.
Mmm. Wow. I thought about you in the did you say you got 1,000 pounds of apples?
Yes.
Wow. I was trying to imagine that because we have apple trees out by the barn, and that is an immense amount of apples. Wow.
It's a box of apples, and we get it at a farm that has thousands of those boxes. This is the Hudson River Valley. It's one of the world's largest apple-growing regions.
What we have
are culps. They're cider apples, right? So they're slightly bruised, or they have a nick in them, or a wasp took a bite. They're the apples that, in the sorting house, were sorted out.
I see. Wow. So have you made all of your butters and the ciders? Have you pressed it out and done all that yet?
Yes. The basic answer is yes. The apple bin, the wooden apple bin, is empty. Those apples have turned into apple cider. Right now it's juice, but it will become cider. And applesauce. And apple butter, which is just sauce cooked longer. And we don't put anything in it. It's just the apples. And there's some apples set aside for, like, what if I want to eat an apple? Or what if I want to make an apple pie? And I'm sliced and cored about 20 apples and drenched them in lemon juice and hung them up to dry.
Oh, nice. Wow.
Yes, the lemon juice keeps them from discoloring since I don't use a dehydrator.
Mm-hmm. That's so marvelous.
And you can use it, you can do it even if you use a dehydrator, but then usually you want to, like, put wax paper or something on your dehydrator because the lemon juice does make it a little bit messy. I had one of my strings broke, so I got a spa treatment of lemon-drenched apple rings all over my head and hair and face. That's the great part about homesteading. You always get free beauty treatments.
Yes, and they're usually the best fresh from the fridge or the field. Yes, I love it. I love that. Well, we've not been putting up apples, and we didn't have a lot of greens this year, so I've mostly just been playing in the yard, and now that the leaves have fallen, I'm really able to put down the seeds that go down in the fall without worry of breaking them away, so I've been doing that, and just hanging out with the goaties, really, getting used to the time change. It always feels a little jarring to me the first couple days, but yeah.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is, but, you know, whenever I switch time zones or whenever they change the time, I take a really firm attitude of not looking back. You know, there's so many people who live in California and they come to New York and it's like 3 o'clock and they say, oh, well, it's noon back home. That's what I mean by looking back. Right,
yeah.
Or even the other way around. It's not like looking back in time. It's like looking back to where you were. No, this is the agreed-upon unit of measurement for this place at this time. So just go with it, because really, it doesn't matter.
Right. Be fully present.
It's not worth bucking. There's enough in life that you're going to want to be aggravated about without it being that.
Oh, for sure.
And the moon is gorgeous tonight, too.
Oh, I saw it rising when I was coming in from closing the barn. So beautiful.
Yes.
Yes.
And that's a nice part of the time change.
Yes, I like being out in the barn at night in the dark, much more than in the morning in the dark.
Uh-huh.
I just deserve that. I wouldn't have expected that, but at night in the dark in the barn is just so, there's something about it. But, yeah, the morning I appreciate the light.
And there's enough windows in our barn that on nights like this with the full moon, you can do the barn by moonlight. You can do milk. You can milk by moonlight.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's pretty fun.
Uh-huh.
Wow. As it would have it, the one light in our barn that doesn't work is in the stall where I milk. So I'm often milking in the darkest place in the barn.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, last year we said, oh, golly gee, it's just so much easier to freeze the applesauce. Right? It's just like, put it into the bags and put it into the freezer and wash up and you're done. It's like, so much easier than canning it, which is what we've pretty much always done. Occasionally we've frozen it. And then we talked about it this year and we agreed that it cuts down on the amount we can give away to freeze it.
Oh.
It's really hard to say to someone, you know, hi, but I'm so happy to be here. Here's a quarter frozen applesauce.
Right.
In a plastic bag. It's just uncool. Right? It's like, it's not like giving them a jar with a pretty label.
This is so true.
And,
wow.
Right. And I mean, I think we're going to be putting up between 25 and 30 quarts of applesauce. You know, there's far more applesauce than I could ever eat. The whole intention of getting the apples is to have enough to give away. So we just said, all right, we're committed. We're going to can this year.
Wow.
It takes a little more, but on the other hand, once it's canned, you're not dependent on any more energy input. Whereas when you freeze it, you have to have constant energy input to keep it frozen.
So are you like sterilizing the jars with hot water and then doing a hot water bath when you fill them, or how do you?
You know what I do? You know, the canning pot has a metal rack, right? And I just put the jars in the metal rack and put it in the boiling water. And then I take them out, empty the water out of the jar, if I want to, into another pan, wipe the rim of the jar, fill the jar, wipe the rim again, put the lid on, put it in the boiling water, take another jar out, dump the water out. That way I don't like, you know, have the deal where you're lowering the rack into the boiling water and it's too much boiling water and suddenly it's like blah, all over the stove and your feet.
Right? Oh, wow. Yeah.
So by sterilizing the jars, by boiling them in the canner, with the canner with the right amount of water, and then taking them out with the water in them and emptying that water into something else, down the drain or keeping it, you know, if you want to conserve that water, that way I have the right amount of water in my canner, too.
Wow. Very nice.
Yeah, and then I don't have to go through a whole other thing about sterilizing them. They're just in there in the boiling water for as long as it takes me to get my applesauce boiling and get my funnel and my scraper and my head together.
Wow.
Right?
Sounds like undertaking.
It is. It is. Canning, you have to be like really, really present and really rigorously there.
Mm-hmm.
And we also decided that we were going to invest in new jars, even though we have jars, because it's always tragic when a jar breaks in the boiling water.
Oh, boy, that would be tragic.
It is. And they break around the bottom.
Mm.
You know where the bottom kind of curves?
Absolutely. Yep, that makes sense.
It breaks right there at the curve.
Wow. And then the bottom, does it stay in one piece usually and the rest falls apart?
No, it's just two pieces, the jar and the bottom. But, of course, all the contents is all in the boiling water and all over the other jars, and it is a capital M-E-S-S.
Right. Well worth the investment of new jobs.
Well worth the investment of new jars. So we have a very exciting guest who's going to be with us tonight. I don't think that we've ever talked to anyone on the show who's a Reiki master. Now, there's lots of people out there who do Reiki, including Justine. Justine does Reiki. And why are you not opening? Do not be difficult now. Put yourself in an open mood. Thank you. And our guest tonight, Dr. Ginny Whitelaw, is an 86th generation Rinzai Zen master, a Chosai Zen priest, and the founder of the Institute for Zen Leadership. So she's going to be telling us about some real root experiences and understandings and teachings behind a lot of the things that have come into common usage that perhaps we don't really understand the depth of them. She wants to transform leadership and turn it into perma-leadership, like permaculture. So stay with us until 9 o'clock or come back so that you can hear Dr. Ginny Whitelaw. Do we have anybody with any questions?
Yes, we have a caller that has pressed 1 to raise their hand. I'll remind everyone listening that if you've got a question this evening, you'll need to press 1 to raise your hand, and that will allow us to see you in the queue. And we have two callers that have pressed 1. the first caller has dialed in from the 313 area code. From the 313, you are live with Susan.
Susan, good evening. It's Zara.
Good evening. Hey.
Hey. So my question tonight is about my wisdom teeth.
Oh, dear. Dear, dear.
Oh, dear. So I have one wisdom tooth that's growing, like, right out the side into my cheek. And I haven't really had any problems with it until this past week. And I started getting, like, tightness in my jaw. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't opening very far, but it also wasn't really hurting me. But then I started taking echinacea, poke, because I don't want it to get infected. It didn't seem infected at all, but it was awkward.
Yeah, so, it sounds like.
Yeah, like I couldn't even brush my teeth really hard.
Oh, no.
To like pry my teeth open.
Oh, dear. Not good.
So it's a bit better today. I took a lot of echinacea over the last 4 days. Poke. I was spraying some yarrow back there and putting echinacea kind of right on it so it would numb it.
Uh-huh.
And so it seems like it's better today. But I also went to the dentist. And the dentist said that they could take it out for me, so they're going to take it out in a couple weeks. But they wanted to, I also have another wisdom tooth, so I was wondering if I should get them both taken out, because the dentist is like, well, we just take them both out, but I don't know if that's necessary. And then the other thing was that my dentist wanted to put me on antibiotics right now. And I was like, no, thanks. I don't think I need that. And so she was like, okay, well, I don't know anything about herbs, so I believe you that you can handle this, but I would prefer if you started taking antibiotics now. But
What I say at that point is consider it done. Consider it done. I'm taking antibiotics. When I was in the medical system and they said, you're not doing chemotherapy, I said, I am doing chemotherapy. I am doing mistletoe therapy. It's not your chemotherapy, but it is chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not her antibiotics, but it is antibiotics. Consider it done.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I ended the conversation with her with saying, thank you for putting your trust in me that I will be able to not have an infection when I come in next time.
Right. Exactly. Well,
okay,
and she's worried about you're getting an infection from the extraction. One of the first actions that I took as an adult was to have my wisdom teeth extracted, all four of them. It changed my life.
Did you have that at the same time?
As I recall, it was two at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you if it was like right side, left side, or above and below, but I'm guessing it was one side and then the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was 20. And I have never regretted having my wisdom teeth removed. One of the things that Weston Price, literally shows, in his photographs, is that as the diet changes, the human jaw becomes too small for there to be room for the wisdom teeth. Mm. And they come in, they shove and crowd all of the other teeth, and for no good.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was in my 20s, I didn't have wisdom teeth. And
so I hear they're just emerging now.
Yeah, so I only have two, and they've emerged in the last 5 years.
Must be all that comfrey you're drinking.
Oh, darn.
I was so impressed when I was in West Virginia at the herb conference there that a woman who, she doesn't do the research herself, but she researches what other people are researching so that she can report on it. And she said that they have found that comfrey both promotes the growth of the cells that build bone and limits the growth of the cells that eat bone.
Wow. Okay. So
one's an osteoblast and one's an osteoclast, but I'm not even going to pretend that I remember which is which.
Okay, so my next question is, for my own personal treatment, do you think that echinacea is enough, or should I add in some other herbs?
You're asking me to predict the future.
Okay. I hear you. I hear you on that.
You are alert enough to know.
I will go
when you need to up
intuition.
The ante, either by increasing the dose of echinacea, decreasing the amount of time between doses, adding poke root to it, using some usnea, whatever you think, yarrow topically, whatever you think is going to be the most help for you, I know that that's what you're going to do.
Okay. Thank you. Thank
you're
you, Susan. Okay. So do I have time to ask one other question?
Yes.
Okay. So this one isn't about me, but it's about my friend who is 3 years old, and she has had 5 double ear infections in the last year. And her parents are kind of really at a loss these days because of the antibiotic-resistant infection, because it keeps coming back and they keep giving her antibiotics. So I guess my question is, is that something that they culture? And then if so, would I be able to, help her with herbs? Since it seems like they're at a loss in the medical system.
I'm not exactly sure what their culturing, the infection would have to do with your helping her with herbs.
Okay.
So my experience has been that anti-infective herbs work against infection.
Mm-hmm.
The dose has to be large enough and has to be frequent enough, but they do work against infection.
Yeah.
And they don't create resistant bacteria.
Yeah.
The eustachian tube, the tube that connects the ear to the mouth, in children is more parallel and less slanty. Like if you think of where your jaw hinge is and where your ear opening is, that's kind of a line that slants down. And if you think of a child's face, where the jaw hinge is and where the ear opening is, it's like more like a parallel or a straight line, which means that if they go to sleep with anything in their mouth, it can easily get into their ear.
Okay, so it could be like a bottle or a
sippy
cup or something like that.
Anything in her
causing
mouth.
Causing the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And
yeah,
I know that it can be hard for them to go to sleep. You
mm-hmm.
know, if they're acclimated to going to sleep sucking on something.
Yes. Yes. Okay,
So the other option is to have tubes installed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically just little, tubes that are slanted.
Mm.
Right? And so that doesn't happen.
I see. Yeah, I have known some people that have had tubes because of dealing with the consistent ear infections. And so would you think that it would be, so then that would be a bacterial infection?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because if it was viral, then it would go away. Like it would clear. And there would be other different symptoms.
In general, children's ear infections are bacterial infections.
Okay. Yeah, my kids never really had problems with ear infections. So I don't really have much experience with it, and I'm feeling very sorry for this little girl. And she's having high fevers.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, it's antibiotic resistant. So feel like I need to come in and
So when you say it's antibiotic resistant, you mean that the fever doesn't come down when she takes antibiotics?
Right. So it's because she's had like multiple ones over the last year. I think she's had 5 or 6 double
mm-hmm.
ear infections.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's like the first time it was able to be treated fine. But it's like now it's on the fifth or the sixth one, and that it's not working the way that it was, the antibiotics.
So even when she takes the antibiotics, she continues to be in pain and have a fever?
Yes.
Well, this is certainly a perfect place to say, let's try some herbs before we go for surgery.
Yes, because at this point now she's getting shots of the antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. And again, my experience is the way that we're using herbs as tinctures in vodka, there aren't any bad reactions with drugs. You can use anti-infective herbs with anti-infective drugs, and it's okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That is important.
Mm-hmm. And if you find it's not okay, come back and tell us.
Yes.
But, before I published Abundantly Well, for the 2 years before it came out, in 2018 and 2019, where I taught at quite a few conferences, and I asked everybody at those conferences, every opportunity I had, my classes and at dinner and so on, there was thousands and thousands of people, to tell me about interactions between drugs and nourishing herbal infusions or tinctures made with fresh plants in 100-proof vodka. And there were none.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, people said it, really the only interactions they'd ever seen was when the herbs were used in capsules.
Yeah. I have not had any problems with giving tinctures to anyone, including my dog, my children. No bad reactions whatsoever.
And not just reactions to the tinctures, but no interactions if they're taking drugs concurrently, even drugs that do the same thing.
Okay, yeah.
Right. It's like people can take a drug that's to lower their blood pressure and take hawthorn and or motherwort and or passiflora, and it's not like suddenly their blood pressure is going to plummet and they're going to faint.
They faint, yeah.
Which is what people are worried about. Well, it's an additive effect. You have the drug that's doing this and then the herb that's doing this. And so then they're, because herb, that's not how herbs are doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's some type of like modulation with the herbs.
Well, herbs have hundreds of different constituents, so they're just a little more complicated than drugs.
Yeah, they're more complicated, so they work in like a broader holographic way.
Right, in a more complicated way, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much, Susan, for your
thank you for your wonderful questions.
Using the herbs.
Yes.
I will let you know. I am going to work with this little girl. I will let you know how it goes. I'm confident that I can heal myself and deal
Good.
With my extractions.
All right.
Okay, well, I'll talk to you soon. I love you so much.
Love you, Sarah. Love you lots. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, green blessings.
Green blessings.
All right, and I'll remind everyone listening, if you've got a question and would like to speak live with Susan this evening, you'll need to press 1 so that we can see your hands go up in the queue. At this time, we have one caller that has raised their hand, and you are dialed in from the 607 area code. From the 607, you are live with Susan.
Hi, Susan. Can you hear me all right?
Hi.
Hi, my name is Valerie, calling from Gilbertsville, New York. And this is my first time talking to you, and I'm so happy to be able to talk with you, ask you a question or two. I've been using herbal medicine for many years. I've been following the Dr. Hulda Clark's protocol for cleansing and so forth, and then I use herbs for other things too. The information I've been doing research on and I'm trying to find answers to is how to use Queen Anne's lace as a contraceptive for my cats. I guess I would like your opinion on that. I ordered a tincture.
The part of Queen Anne's lace that is the contraceptive is the seeds.
Yes, and I have a tincture.
Tincture doesn't work.
Oh, the tincture doesn't work?
Correct. The seeds is the part that's medicinal.
Well, this is Queen Anne's lace seeds tincture.
Not the tincture, the seeds.
Okay, but this is a tincture made from the seeds.
Does it work?
Well, I did try it. The last time she was in heat, I did try it, and she didn't get pregnant. So, but I'm sort of in the dark. I haven't talked to anyone yet who knows what they're doing with regard to applying this to animals.
Well, Robin Rose Bennett picked up on a piece of information in my book, Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year.
I got your book, yes. Mm-hmm.
When I said that women in India used Queen Anne's lace seed, and the way they used it was they took a tablespoonful of the seed and they mixed it into food.
Okay.
And they took a tablespoonful mixed into food, which means they chewed it and swallowed it and digested it for about 3 days mid-cycle. And over a period of 10 or 15 years, I would think, maybe even longer, Robin Rose actively talked to women about using wild carrot seed and explored various ways of using it. And what she found was that it's highly effective when the seed is chewed up.
Hmm.
And is it no more effective than guesswork when the tincture is used, at least for human beings? It would be different for cats.
What you said about
perhaps that's what you're telling us. I'm certainly open to that being true. I have nothing against it.
Mm-hmm.
But what she advises human women to do is to get the seeds and chew them up. Now, possibly, if you had seeds, you could grind them and put them in the cat's food.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that's going on here is that if you think about eating a tablespoonful of seed or even a teaspoonful of seeds,
mm-hmm,
chewed up or ground up into your food, and then you try to convert that into tincture,
mm-hmm,
it would probably be like half a cup of tincture.
Hmm. So, okay.
Right?
I don't know. The tincture...
Well,
mm-hmm.
Did you make the tincture?
No, I bought it.
Uh-huh, I understand.
And it's a glycerin-based.
It's not even a tincture.
What did you say? It's not a tincture?
It's not a tincture. Glycerin doesn't make a tincture.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, it says here, wild carrot tincture... glycerin.
It can say anything it wants. I have a bottle that says cannabis tincture, and what's inside it is oil.
Mm-hmm.
Worse
okay.
yet, somebody gave me a cup of yogurt, and it said honey vanilla yogurt. When I read the ingredients, there was neither honey nor vanilla in it. And when I called the company, they said, well, we don't have to put honey and vanilla in it just because it says it as part of the name.
Mm-hmm. For heaven's sakes.
For heaven's sakes, what?
Well, anyway, the instructions on this for humans is to take 1 to 3 droppers full as needed. And I gave her 8 drops mixed with a tiny bit of water each day for, I think it was about 8 days. During when she was in heat and for a few days afterwards.
Well, then I would say is do it again.
Yeah, and see if it works. Yeah.
Right.
The thing about the chewing is, of course, the cats don't chew. They
right.
Yeah. They what do? They tear apart.
Yeah, they just kind of rend it and swallow.
Right.
So they're very, very strong stomach acid.
Yeah, but in general, with herbs, with applying that to like a small animal, would you just essentially just reduce the amount based on the size, you know, how the size of the animal compared to the human? I'm not
given
phrasing this very well.
Given that there are 10,000 herbs currently in use as herbal medicine, I can't make a blanket statement about it. And the thing I can say is that most cats do very poorly when given real tincture, and a tincture is something that's alcohol-based.
I see.
Like you have a glyceride, not a tincture. And some cats are wildly allergic to tinctures and foam at the mouth and go into convulsions.
The ones with the alcohol, you mean?
A real tincture, an actual tincture, not a glyceride, a tincture.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So,
so
that
I
was
just...
the other thing I was thinking when you were saying you had tincture, is cat, tincture, not good combination.
I see. Okay, so this is a glyceride. Okay.
Glyceride, right, which means that it hasn't, I would suspect that it has virtually none of the constituents of the wild carrot seed in it.
Really?
Really.
Huh. Interesting. Very interesting. Well, I could feed her, feed the kitty, you know, ground up, you know, the ground up seeds. And maybe I'll try that too.
Do you have seeds?
I did collect some this fall.
Good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I can grind them with just a little mortar and pestle, I suppose.
Yeah, electric grinder is probably better.
Okay.
Like a little coffee grinder.
Coffee grinder, okay.
Right, but you don't want one that's actually ground coffee because I don't think cats like coffee.
No. No. Okay, well, I appreciate this. I'll have to order some more seeds, too, because I didn't collect, you know, all that much.
They're not generally not an item of commerce.
Oh, yes, but I did find a site that had the
that actually sells.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Good on that.
Well, I have another question, too. I've made a couple of other tinctures based on your recipes here. The goldenrod, which I think is marvelous. I just absolutely love goldenrod tincture. And a stevia tincture, what else? Cloves and a few others. Anyway, but I cannot find, I'm looking for organic vodka, and I cannot find 100 proof. I can find 90 proof. But where do you get 100 proof vodka? Have you found any? That's organic, or?
I'm not very worried about it being organic.
Oh, yeah, okay. But isn't vodka made from corn?
No.
Pardon?
No.
Oh, what is it made of? Potatoes?
First of all, let me say this. There is no GMO corn in the human food chain.
In the human what?
In the human, in, there's, vodka's, not, if it's made from corn, which it isn't, it wouldn't be made from GMO corn, which is what I think you're worried about.
Yeah, but I think, it, I guess vodka's
and
made from potatoes.
Don't be worried.
Don't be worried.
Do not be worried. Don't be worried.
Okay.
What is a genetic modification? What does that mean?
Well, I would rather not use a GMO.
Why is it that you would rather not use it?
Because I think they're not natural. They're not natural.
Okay, let's just talk about this for a moment. What is a genetic modification?
It's when they go in and change the genes.
All right. Now, let me ask you this. Have you ever eaten cabbage?
Yes.
All right. Is there a wild plant that makes a head of cabbage?
No.
All right.
I'm aware of.
And get from the wild mustard plant to the head of cabbage you are eating required women to genetically modify the plant. In fact, the mustard plant, the Brassica oleraceae, is so easily modified that we have taken that one plant, Brassica oleraceae, and we have made from it cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, kale and collards, those are all the same plant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're all genetically modified because that's how we eat, is by genetically modifying plants. And we have forever, for at least 30,000 years, human beings have been hard at work genetically modifying plants. Now, let's look a little deeper into this. We're talking about genes, right? Genetically modified.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this. Are there fish genes and human genes and tomato genes?
Mm-hmm. Well, my concern is more
I would like, really like you to answer me.
Okay, I'm sorry. What was your question?
Are there fish genes, tomato genes, and human genes?
And what about them?
Would I be able to say these are fish genes, these are human genes,
oh,
these
course,
are tomato
yes.
genes?
Yes.
No. No, I could not.
Oh.
No. No. Genetic material is exactly the same in every living organism and consists of four base pairs.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. Okay.
So this, if I gave you a nail
mm-hmm.
that had been used, could you tell me if it had been used in a church or an outhouse?
Hmm, interesting. No. Probably not.
It is truly all one. It's not just a saying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me give you a specific so that you begin to see how your mind has been distorted and led into paranoia and fear. When I was in New Zealand, I met a woman there who was pretty excited about some work that she had been doing. In fact, she had come there really depressed. She was deeply concerned about small farmers and that worldwide climate change was putting small farmers out of business and enriching the wealthy agribusiness.
Mm-hmm.
And what she wanted to do was to make a frost-proof tomato.
Mm-hmm.
Because one night of 30 degrees and your tomato crop is ruined.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
right.
happening more and more in areas that grow tomatoes. And she thought, it's not unnatural, for goodness sakes. There's plants that stay green all year long. There must be a not-freeze gene.
Mm-hmm.
So she spent a lot of time, she told me, trying to get to the not-freeze gene. She said, and it was like doing plumbing blindfolded on your back with your left hand in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
The not-freeze gene in the plants that don't freeze is so old that it's deep down in there, and she just couldn't get to it. And finally, in despair, she gave up, went for a vacation to New Zealand. And, of course, people whose minds are active are never really on vacation. And somebody said to her, do you know that there are fish that swim in waters that are below freezing in Antarctica? And she said, what? Yeah, it's salty water. So the water can actually be liquid and below freezing, and the fish swim in it. She says, whoa. So she managed to get herself some of these fish. And the not-freeze gene turned out to be from a plant.
Hmm, interesting.
That the fish had taken in to make itself able to swim in those sub-freezing water.
Very interesting.
And because this had happened relatively recently evolutionarily, which means like only hundreds of millions of years ago,
mm-hmm.
not thousands of hundreds of millions of years ago, she was able to get it.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
She was able to get the not-freeze gene that came from the plant that was in the fish and put it in the tomato. Did she put a fish gene in a tomato?
That's very interesting.
She didn't, did she? Because there aren't any fish genes.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't any tomato genes. They're simply genes.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
It's the most natural thing in the world. And everyone that I've met who's working in genetic modification is a loving, large-hearted, concerned person, most of them being women.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want to feed everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to take care of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay. I just want to stay away
think
from Roundup
have
Ready.
Anything to worry about. Furthermore, there has never been any genetically modified plants in England, whereas in the United States, we've already eaten canola oil, and canola oil is genetically modified. It's the first genetically modified food. It's been in public consumption for over 40 years in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did was we took the 50 most common causes of medical deaths, not like, you know, accidents and so on, but, you know, heart disease,
mm-hmm.
specific kinds of cancer and so on. And we compared the rates in England and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a country which had never eaten GMOs and a country where GMOs had been eaten for 40 years, and what we found was no difference of any kind.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, anyway, I just
we
want
to
stay away
led
from,
to
I
be
just
frightened
want to purchase
of
organic.
Something because if you're frightened of it, you're not going to support wise use of it. You're going to let the bad people make all the rules.
The what people?
The bad people.
The
people who don't, aren't for people. The bad people. The
I
people
don't
care
hear,
about people. Because you're opting out. Because
the
of paranoia.
Always clear
and
on
I
phone.
Say that paranoia has been brought about by the people who are standing to profit. And that if
mm-hmm.
we get over our paranoia, we will be able to use GMOs for the good of all.
Okay.
They're not going away. And they're not bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. And vodka isn't made of corn.
No, true. But I just wanted to mention one thing, if I may,
yeah.
And that is that Roundup Ready corn is genetically modified to accept the pesticides that they're putting on. It's the pesticides I want to stay away from.
Roundup is not a pesticide.
Roundup
is an herbicide.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What is it?
It's an herbicide.
Okay.
It's not a pesticide.
Okay, well, anyway, herbicide, pesticide, I would like to stay away from herbicides.
Well, they are very different.
Mm-hmm.
They're extremely different.
Okay, well, I definitely want to stay away from herbicides.
Things that are organic doesn't mean they're safe. For instance, here in the Hudson River Valley, a lot of apples are grown. And it's a river valley, which means when the trees are blossoming, mold is likely. And so usually a fungicide is sprayed. Now, that can be a so-called non-organic fungicide, which biodegrades in about 36 hours, or you can use an organic fungicide, which is copper sulfate, which builds up in the soil and the water and makes the land unusable within about 100 years.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting.
Okay. Organic doesn't mean safe or good.
Mm-hmm.
In
well,
many
I
instances, non-organic is safer and better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go out of my way to buy non-organic things, but I also don't necessarily go out of my way to buy organic vodka, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we think about the chemicals we want to avoid, and I'm with you. I don't want to be eating a lot of chemicals. Nobody wants to be eating a lot of chemicals. Yuck! But let's think about chemicals and how they get into and out of our bodies. And we can just make a broad stroke. There are water-soluble chemicals, and there are oil-soluble chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And water-soluble chemicals, well, there's a water-soluble chemical in asparagus. What happens to it?
I don't know.
What happens when you eat asparagus and then you pee?
Right.
What happens? Does your pee smell?
I suppose. I hadn't noticed, but I don't eat that much asparagus.
Well, there's a very strong smell. in most people's urine from the asparagus, because water soluble chemicals usually leave your body within an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Your body doesn't hang on to water soluble chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
They're not a problem. Oil soluble chemicals are a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really much of a solvable problem, because once you ingest an oil-soluble chemical, it literally fuses into your genetic material and every cell in your body, which is protected by a lipid layer as well as your fat cells.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't detoxify.
So you cannot
The whole, you know, campaign about detoxification is simply a way for people to make a lot of money, and unfortunately for many of the people they deal with, to get a lot sicker because of the really wrong idea of there being anything that's toxic or that needs to be cleansed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this has been very helpful, and you've really opened up...
Can I take this one step further for you, just to help us all a little bit? So oil-soluble chemicals, as I said, pretty much are stuck in your body once you get them in there. But that's not 100% true. There are actually four ways that your body can get oil-soluble chemicals out.
Mm-hmm.
They're not great ways, but they're there. Every time you ovulate, your egg, which has a lot of fatty material, contains those chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Every time a man ejaculates, every sperm contains those chemicals.
Okay.
When you lactate, when you breastfeed, your milk contains those chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, women above the Arctic Circle can no longer breastfeed their babies because their milk is so contaminated with chemicals, because these are called persistent organic pollutants, and they build up in the food chain, never, ever leaving.
Mm. Wow.
In other words, you cannot detoxify from them. The earth can't be detoxified. Your body can't be detoxified ever from these. But they do come out in your eggs, your seeds, your milk. And what does that mean for us in terms of buying organic?
I don't know. What?
It means that every bit of fat that we eat should be organic.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah,
if we're not buying organic olive oil and organic butter, then anything else organic is kind of silly.
Yeah.
And any product that contains a lot of fat, milk, cheese, eggs, those are the kinds of things that need to go to the top of our list in terms of buying organic.
Okay. Well, I do, I do eat organic.
So long as you do that, that's great.
But it's not necessary.
Like, you know, we'll go out and they'll buy, like, organic produce, and then they'll buy the cheap butter. And I understand. I really understand the impulse.
Yeah.
And just, you know, just to kind of, like, help myself envision what was going on, I roughly figured the amount of chemicals that would actually wind up in 1 pound of non-organic butter. And it was the rough equivalent of the amount of chemicals that you would ingest by eating non-organic produce for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because it's concentrated into the milk and then it's concentrated into the butter.
Yep. Well, I so agree. Yes.
Great. Great. Thanks for letting me go through all that with you.
Thank you for the information. I'll worry more or less about the plants.
Exactly. The plants are phytoremediators, right?
I guess. I don't know. Phytoremediators?
It gets rid of heavy metals and radiation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just got a letter from someone who said, you know, I don't know if you remember me. I took classes with you long ago, you know, when I was a kind of a spunky kid, and I just want you to know that I went to college, and because of you, I majored in phytoremediation, and that's what I do worldwide now. I'm a worldwide consultant in phytoremediation.
Wow.
Right, and, you know, we're using plants, we're using mushroom myceliums to sop up oil spills, to really change what's happening when there are disasters, to make them not disasters. So hooray for all of the ways that humans and plants play together.
Mm-hmm. Well, wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I so appreciate all this information. And I'll let you know how it works with my kitty cat also.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
If it continues to work.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Well, let us know either way, okay?
I will.
And
in the meantime,
really
if you'd
like
to adopt a kitten. I'll I'm kidding. Thank you so much.
Good blessings.
Thank
Good
you.
Night.
Okay. Goodbye.
All right, and at this time, I don't see any hands raised in the queue, so I'll remind everyone listening, if you have a question, you do need to press 1 so that we can see your hand go up, and there we go. I have a caller that has pressed 1 in the 317 area code. The 317, you are live.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
I have wanted your opinion about something. There's an apartment complex that's close to my house, and in the middle of their parking lot, there is a power line pylon, and I know that I've heard that it's not good to collect herbs or, you know, to forage herbs that are underneath power lines, and I'm wondering how dangerous that is for the people who live in that apartment complex to live with the pylon in their parking lot. Did that make sense? I get nervous sometimes.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's actually two different issues.
Okay.
So the first issue is nature safe? Or is nature only safe if there isn't any human interference?
Okay.
Are the plants growing under the pylon?
No, my concern is that if
it's
not good.
I'm curious. Are there plants growing under it? Is it sprayed
or
something?
No, it's a parking lot.
It's a parking lot. Okay.
Right in the middle.
But what about the next pylon? What about the next pylon in line? The ones where there are plants. Are the plants grow under them?
I haven't.
Because you said it's not safe to harvest plants.
Well,
so I
want
to know: are plants growing there? If it's not safe to harvest them, they must be growing there. Is what I'm saying.
I was speaking in terms like but in general.
But if they're growing there, then I'm going to trust that it is safe to harvest them.
That's not my concern is that people who live there shouldn't be a pylon
that's
in the middle of the parking lot.
That's a totally different thing because people are mammals and not plants.
Okay.
So you can't say this orange has a rind, therefore we have to peel the grapes.
Okay.
You can't compare plants, and especially a spurious belief about plants and electricity to people and then carry over that spurious belief about the plants and the electricity to people as though somehow that all, like, equaled out or worked. It doesn't at all. However, I'm not saying that electricity has no effect on people.
Okay.
In fact, not just electricity. There's AM radio and FM radio, and there's broadband, and there's television, there's broadcast, and there's radar and sonar, and there's all kinds of stuff going on through your head and your body, you know?
Yes, ma'am.
In fact, the medical literature doesn't even have a disease called anxiety until we started putting all of these different energies into the air. Interesting, huh?
Yes. What was that last word you said in your sentence? The last
until we started putting different kinds of vibrations, energies, into the air. So this is invisible to most people.
Okay.
Right. And then when it gets visible to them, it comes with a whole boatload of paranoia about it.
Okay. Thank
and
you.
And it's one of those things, it's like someone, it's like two, you know, us being in the ocean and someone taking us someplace and saying, look at this area, it's wet.
Thank you. That calms me. Thank you so
right?
much.
Right. I mean, we are awash in the stuff. That said, I wouldn't want to live under a high tension line. I did almost buy a property that had a high tension line running through it.
Okay.
In fact, from Niagara Falls down to New York City. But the goddess, of course, always intervenes and protects me. Thank you very much. And while that was happening, because of the title search coming back really bunky, I realized that the man of the household had had several heart attacks and that she had a pacemaker.
Oh.
Right. Oh, a pacemaker. What? Because the electrical activity of your heart is not working? Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my friend Ryan Drum, when he decided that he was going to harvest herbs and make herbs available to people, he wanted to have only the highest quality herbs. And so he moved to an island where there is no electricity.
Wow.
So he would say, as I am saying, you know, we're just talking a matter of degree as to whether you're harvesting under a pylon or harvesting 10 feet away from a pylon or harvesting a mile away from a pylon, because all of us and all of the plants are constantly bathed in all of these vibrations.
Okay.
Right?
Right, right.
And if the plants are growing there, then I'm going to say they're okay. Now, again, remember, I ask you, has it been sprayed? Because often under these lines, they do spray herbicides.
Okay.
And you definitely can't harvest plants then because all the plants are dead and brown. The great thing about Roundup, I'm not a Roundup lover, but it has some good things to it. And one of them is that it's actually a lot less problematic than the stuff it replaced. And the other thing is it stays put. So if you put Roundup someplace,
yeah,
the plant right next to it doesn't have any.
Okay.
It doesn't leach out into the ground and spread.
Oh.
My daughter shares like a fence row with a neighbor. So there's a flower bed, a fence, and a flower bed. And
right.
He puts Roundup on his flower bed. And her flower bed is filled with echinacea and goldenrod and wild grape. And obviously, Roundup isn't touching it, right?
Right.
I tend to be less paranoid about living in the world than many other people.
Okay.
Possibly because I know what's really going on.
Yeah.
There's no place to run. There's no place to hide.
Right.
When I was teaching in Alaska, there were some researchers there from UCLA, and they had been studying the amount of chemicals in the water, the soil, and the air in the Los Angeles basin. And they decided they would go to Alaska and measure the water, soil, and the air up there so that they could make a comparison. And what they found was that there was a lot more chemicals in Alaska than in Los Angeles.
Oh.
There's no place to hide.
That surprises me about Alaska.
Because of the way the currents and the winds blow?
I just thought it would I'm surprised that there's more. You said there's more chemicals there?
You bet. Because of the way the winds and the currents blow.
That's sad. It's the last frontier is what I was thinking.
Well, when I said that there's chemicals in the egg and chemicals in the sperm, if you put two and two together, or even one and one together, you would say, are you telling me, Susan, that all human beings born since the 40s have been born of eggs and sperm already pre-contaminated with chemicals? I would have to say yes. And I thought, not only that, we have been looking at cord blood for, golly, I don't know, maybe 75 years now. And the number of chemicals has gone up and up and up in cord blood at birth till it's now, I think, over 450 different chemicals found in the placental blood.
That's awful.
And we're going to, like, concern ourselves about organic this or organic that. We're preloaded.
Yes, ma'am.
And then, and they're not leaving. No detoxification is going to do anything to it. So, thanks for your question. Thanks for being here. I appreciate your green blessing.
One more thing, ma'am.
Oh, one more thing. Didn't mean to cut you off.
By chance, will you ever be coming to Indiana to do like a conference or class or anything?
If there's a conference going on in Indiana and I get invited, then I am happy to go. That's what happened in West Virginia. They hit the West Virginia Herbalist Conference, and they said, will you come and be our keynote speaker? And I said, oh, gee, sure.
Okay. And one more thing. What do you think about the cottonwood tree? Does it really have a lot of medicinal?
I love cottonwood. I love aspens. I love poplars. I love balm of Gilead. The whole populace. Genus is just so delightful to sit, you know, on a beautiful fall day and see the golden leaves shimmer and shake in the sun, whether it's my quaking aspen or the aspen of the Rockies or the cottonwoods deep down by the waters or the balm of Gileads as you go west. Poplars are trees that come in fast, grow fast, provide lots of forage. Animals love it.
Yeah.
And all of it, you know, provides not just the balm of Gilead. All the buds are aromatic, the balm of Gilead especially so, right?
Right. And it's in the Bible, too.
Isn't it, though? They're worldwide, distributed worldwide. And as I said, they come in fast, you know, so where an area has been disturbed or trees have been cut down, one of the first trees to start growing in that area will be the poplars. And they'll help shade, you know, provide shade for the young hardwoods, the maples,
yes,
the oaks, right, and grow up in the loving care of the poplars.
Yes, ma'am.
I also have, this past year, done my series of shows for HealthyLife.net on trees. And I did a whole hour show on poplars.
Oh, wow.
Medicinal uses, magical uses, all of the different ways the poplars are used. And let me see. This is healthylife.net. And poplar was August.
Okay.
So it might still be there. They archive for 3 or 4 months.
Will you give me that web address one more time, please?
HealthyLife.net. It's a radio station.
Oh, okay.
Radio station, and I'm one of many presenters. Some of them, you know, real like you say, whoa! I mean, they had like really great people. Like they had Lynn Andrews, who did a regular show for them. Bernie Siegel does a show for them. They have wonderful, wonderful people. You'll really be happy to have stumbled onto HealthyLife.net.
Okay, great.
All
Thank
right.
you so much.
You're welcome. Green blessings. Good night.
Good night.
All right, and I do not see any hands that have been raised at this time. I'll remind everyone listening, if you have a question and would like to speak live to Susan, you'll need to press 1 so that we can see your hands go up in the queue. What would you like to do? We have a couple email questions.
I was going to say, I bet there's an email question.
Yes. All right. Let's see here. All right. Hello. Is there anything I can do to help improve and preserve my eyesight? I'm in my early 40s, and I've worn glasses since high school. I see the optometrist every year, and every year my eyesight gets a little worse, and I'm given a new prescription for new glasses. Do you know any ways to help me keep my eyes from getting worse every year? Thank you.
Well, let's first ask ourselves what's going on here. And what's going on is that the light that's coming through the lens of the eye is somehow being distorted so that the image that hits the back of the eye isn't clear. And what's thought does that is muscular tension. So that as we age and we seem to have less muscular tension in our eyes, it becomes harder and harder to see small things near to us. We become able to see things far off more easily. So one of the first things that we also want to acknowledge is that when our eyes are measured, they are measured not to a natural standard. That kind of seems to be the theme of the night, doesn't it? What really is natural? Well, it's not natural to have 20/20 vision. If the vast majority of people in the world wear glasses, then obviously having 20/20 vision isn't natural. It's not normal. It's not the norm. Is it better? If you need glasses in order to do your work, then you need glasses. And I'll tell a little bit about my personal life. I had this thing about kissing people who wore glasses, and I kept making the people I was kissing take their glasses off. And then they had their revenge on me, and they said, we're not going to kiss you until you take your contacts out. And I said, what? Come on. I mean, the glasses get in the way. My contacts don't get in the way. They're adamant. Wow, it's like, you know, I had this made this whole little a mutiny here that was turning on me, my innocent contact wearing here. And so the long and short of it was that we all decided to enroll in a Bates Eyesight Improvement Workshop. And, you know, the Bates method, I'm sure, is still out there. Check it out. It was a lot of fun. I am really glad I did it. I'm really glad I learned about palming, and I'm glad I did the exercises, and I still do them. To this day, I will still palm now and then, and I know about, you know, the kinds of eye exercises that are good for my eyes, and if I'm waiting in line, I'll do them. But really, what I found out during that time was that I see just fine. I just don't measure up. In fact, I'm the only person who's nearly 80 who has to take her glasses off, because, of course, I have glasses, right, to read the phone book. I want to wear glasses for seeing far away, because I still don't see really clearly far away. However, when I fell in Costa Rica and broke my glasses, I couldn't get a the apartment with the optometrist because it was, one of those COVID years, for months and months and months and months and months, and I didn't have any glasses. And I found, you know what? You and I remember all those years back when you said, the truth of the matter is you can see just fine, and here you are, and you don't have your glasses, and you can actually see just fine, because, in fact, the road signs are huge, and the traffic lights are enormous, and you can know the difference between yellow and green and red. It's not like you need your glasses to see that sharply and distinctly. So one of the things that I suggest to anybody who's concerned about their eyesight getting worse and worse and worse is take your glasses off. Wear them less. Right? It's kind of like my sweetheart and I bought the same kind of shoes on the same day. And 2 years later, I said, look at your shoes. They're just wrecked, and mine are like practically new. And he said, you don't wear them. So if you're always wearing your glasses, your eyes are going to adjust to them. Those muscles are going to adjust to that and probably over-adjust them. Then you're going to need stronger lenses, right? Because the muscle actually changes the shape of the eyeball and distorts the lens, right? Think of the lens as having a curve, and then the muscles of the eyeball are like pulling on it and flattening that curve or making it be more extreme. And wearing your glasses according to Bates encourages the muscles not to be in tone because it provides a fixed focal distance which prevents your eyes and the muscles in your eyes from constantly adjusting in the same way that I know that my whole body is healthier because I walk barefoot, not just because I have my feet on the ground, which of course is going to make me healthier, but because when I walk, and I walk over uneven terrain, all of the muscles and the bones and all of the points in my feet are being activated. We are complex beings. When I put on shoes, all of that stops happening. It may be safer for certain feet. I certainly understand that. But we also, even if our feet are at risk, to take our shoes off. We don't have to walk around and just put our feet on the ground. The same thing as one of the first things that Bates suggests is you don't want to keep getting your prescription stronger. Take your glasses off. Take your glasses off. Learn how to palm. Go out in the sun. Get some sunlight. Palm your eyes and see what happens. Did the Bates method make me see better? Goodness gracious, no. Did the Bates method help me to see what I can see? Yes, indeed, with great gratitude. Green blessings. And I guess I could also mention, that the obvious, which is that what makes children blind is lack of keratins. And to keep our eyesight acute and good, we want to include plenty of cooked orange and red foods. So tomato sauce, not raw tomatoes. Baked squash, not carrot juice. And that said, I am wondering if we have the honor of having Dr. Ginny Whitelaw with us.
Yeah, Dr. Whitelaw is here.
How wonderful. Dr. Ginny Whitelaw is an 86th generation Rinzai Zen master, a Chosai Zen priest, and founder of the Institute for Zen Leadership. With more than 25 years developing whole leaders, she is the author of Resonate and The Zen Leader, and co-developer of Phoebe, a personality assessment linking mind and body and behaviors, formerly MP.
Deputy Manager for Integrating NASA's Space Station Program. Dr. Cheney has a PhD in biophysics and a fifth-degree black belt in Aikido. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Susan. How are you?
I am so enjoying the beautiful autumn weather. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And it is beautiful, right? Full moon and all.
Full moon and all. And I woke up just as the eclipse was starting, so I got to see it, although it dawned before it was total here. I was so intrigued by your idea about perma-leadership. Can we just jump right in there and you tell us what perma-leadership is and how you came to it?
Oh, of course. Thank you. Perma-leadership, you know, you think about the ethics of permaculture, care for the planet, care for people, care for the future. And at one level, it's just common sense. At another level, if every leader practiced that in their business and their organization, it would be revolutionary. And that was the aha, the spirit of seeing how could we elevate a form of leadership where people would care the way they would care for their own eyes, you know, that would care out of a place of connectedness, not separation. And that's what we really bring to it from a Zen perspective, is how to help people experience that samadhi, that connectedness, that lets them expand their view one with, not apart from, but apart of. And from that place of connectedness, reimagine what they can heal in their world, you know, whether relationships or the organization or the business models or whatever it is they touch and do, how it could be more whole, more healed, closer to nature, more caring of the relationships and ecosystems of their life. And then to shift themselves, to energize themselves, to become that future and co-create it, to realize it in the principles of thriving living systems, which could be captured in permaculture, for example. So it's a cycle of connect, reimagine, energize, and realize. A cycle that can be applied again and again in your life and mine toward the matters we face to bring about conditions that are more attuned with nature and caring for people, planet, and our shared future.
All right. Yay. And, you know, I think that we are seeing that. I think that more and more we are seeing leadership, especially at small levels, that is connected and caring.
I think we are. You know, it represents a kind of advance in consciousness that is emerging, you know, on the planet and in humanity. An advance in consciousness that feels more connected, and we are seeing it. They're like dots of light. And we're also seeing where the enormous systems that have been created under, I'll call it earlier stages of consciousness, more regressed stages of consciousness, are still very much in power. So there could be, we're kind of in this mixed place right now where business as usual is not working. Systems are disrupted. The global order is changing. The climate is heating up. The biodiversity is collapsing. There's so much changing all at the same time. It's a very dicey time for humanity, for leadership, for families, for society. And we're seeing that response, as you say, more people are starting to find ways to care for that bigger picture. There is much more a resurgence of indigenous wisdom, of returning to permaculture principles and understanding how nature would solve some of the problems we face. So, you know, it's like we have the problem.
I have never found indigenous people to be very involved in permaculture. In fact, I found quite the opposite. In New Zealand, the Maori hunted every bird weighing more than 1 pound to extinction within about 30 years. They burned down 4,000 acres of virgin forest to plant a sweet potato. What's the truth throughout the world? Indigenous people say, we are the people, and all of this is ours, and we can use it any way I want.
in place after place. I've had indigenous people point to extremely rare plants and tell me common uses for it. And I say, shouldn't we conserve this? What if it's all gone? What about our grandchildren? And they say to me, there'll be another plant, a different one. I think permaculture is really important, but I don't think it's indigenous thought.
You know, I don't think that I'm the right person to represent that because I'm not indigenous by nature. I come from a very colonized culture.
Exactly. And you kind of fantasize about what indigenous people are. And indigenous people are us. We're all indigenous on this planet. We live here. You're correct. I think that was a different way of looking at our interconnectedness is arising because, let's face it, most indigenous people in most places were at war with every other indigenous group around them.
What I have learned,
and we've learned to cooperate in these wonderful ways. Now, 86 generations, that's mind-boggling. We're talking like 2,000 years of lineage?
About 1,500 years, yeah, about 1,500, yeah. It then has moved from mind to mind through many generations, from the awakening of Gautama Buddha through China, you know, through 28 generations in India, through generations in China, generations in Japan, and has moved to the West over the last couple of generations.
Wow. Wow. Phenomenal. You know, I often say that being brought up as a Jewish father and a Catholic mother in Dallas, Texas, where you weren't really allowed to be either, and so I was taken off, you know, to Holy Roller churches and other great examples of Christianity. So by the time I was 15, I knew that it was all a pile of steaming you-know-what. What a fertile field for Zen to fall into.
Well, you know, I also grew up in the Catholic Church, and I by the time I was 10 years old, I was asking questions that I couldn't get good answers to. So
right.
Something in me was really questing, was really hungry, and was really wanting to get to the bottom of it. So I think I had that spiritual hunger that you describe as well, and approached it every way I could. When I got to graduate school, I was starting to study martial arts and Aikido, and my Aikido teacher said to me, if you really want to be at the peak of your game, you have to start meditating. And I thought, well, I trust this teacher, so I'm going to do what he said, and found that it made such a radical difference in life. So early on in my training, yes, it was about making life as I knew it better. But there was a crucial stage, especially when my life completely fell apart, where I didn't want to protect my life anymore. And that's when I just dove into the training whole hog. And it was, you know, it was wonderful. Wonderful and difficult, but wonderful. So...
We develop practices so that when life does fall apart, we have something to practice.
Well, it changed my practice then because in a way, when things are humming along well, the ego gets very attached to all those things, right? It's, you know, there's no reason to, right? But when there's the suffering, then the bottom falls out, you just go, whoa. You know, I don't have anything to protect anymore. Everything sucks. So, you know, there's something that just a spaciousness opens up where you can just discover, well, what is this about? Wow. You know, let me sit with that. Let me breathe with that. Let me do everything I can with that.
So did you at that point discover Zen meditation? Was that the meditation form that was available to you?
Well, I'd already started.
Because of your connection with Aikido?
Yeah, my Aikido teacher was training in Zen. He had a wonderful teacher in Hawaii and introduced us to this teacher, and we all started training with this teacher. So that was available to me. Zen was available to me early on, but I would say I kind of danced around its edges for a number of years And then it was probably 8-9 years into my training that I got very serious, deadly serious, because my health had kind of gone down, and so a lot of the dreams that I had about my life or thoughts that I had about my life weren't working out the way I thought they would. So it was kind of when all of that was lost, wow, then I could really train. Then I could really train.
Wow. I was listening to a song today with a wonderful lyric. It says, sometimes the road chooses you instead of the other way around.
Yeah. How would we know? Because melody always goes both ways. So how would we know?
You thought you were in control. Now, Aikido, I think, has a lot to tell us about leadership.
Indeed, it does. It's, you know, it literally translates as the way of harmonizing energy. And harmonizing there doesn't just mean making nice with. It means using, you know, reading, using, redirecting. And so you get very used to reading the energy of situations and working at a more subtle level than just, you know, he said, she said. You know, you're starting to read kind of intention and what's under the surface and how to work with that. And how to merge with it. You know, Aikido is based in the join, you know, how you can merge with different kinds of energy and lead people in ways they can move. And while that's very physically practiced in Aikido, it's a great metaphor for leadership writ large of how you can reach people where they are, join with where their energy is going, or put things in ways they can move toward and help them move in new directions.
Yes, that is really the Aikido move, which is here's this energy coming at you, and instead of countering it, you say, let's go together.
Yeah, thank you very much. Right.
Thank you very much for this gift. Let's go together. You come over here with me, or I'll come over here with you, whichever works better. Right, and suddenly you're going off in the same direction, and they're going, wait a second, you're supposed to be struggling with me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a way to, resolve the conflict rather than feed into it or run away from it, you know. So it gives a different kind of use of power, which is, again, a power that cares for people, cares for the planet, cares for the future. You know, it's a caring, loving kind of power, which I think is so needed in the world.
I was talking to my granddaughter, who's 15, and we were talking about the in New York State, there's a really cool sticker that you can get when you vote. It says, I voted. And it's kind of this multicolored kind of spider monster thing. And it came from a contest that was done among all the school children for a sticker, for the I voted sticker. And the child who won said, you know, there seems to be a lot of conflict in the adults, so I drew this monster, and it's really perfect. And I said to her, really, really, when you come down to it, what this is about is it's between the people who care about other people and the people who care more about themselves.
Yeah, you know, we're living right at the time where it's all unfolding, isn't it? This is an emotional and anxious day for many people as we try to figure out which direction our country is going and. And that's just in the United States. I realize there could be people all over the world listening to this.
Well, all over the world. And to have, you know, that lunar eclipse, you know, charging, you know, the beginning of that day. It's like all of the astrologers are like, about what this is portending and what it's meaning and which seatbelt we should fasten.
That's right, which seatbelt. But, you know, to your point about caring for self, caring for other, that we grow up through stages where we all start out caring for ourselves. I mean, that's what you know, little kids will see everything through the ego once the ego boundary is formed. And then through socialization and through stages of development, increasingly, we start having a broader circle of care. What I have so appreciated about meditation and Zen training in particular is that it opens us to this samadhi, it's called, but a connectedness and experience of being the whole, being a part of, being the other, literally, physically being that is a kind of one witness that where your care isn't just an act of altruism or, quote, being a nice person. It's like the common sense that comes out of a deeper understanding of who you are and what is going on, what this is. So that is, to me, a leap in terms of how we can have that kind of care with one another. If it comes out of our own genuine experience that, you know, in a sense, you're an other self, you know, in a sense, this is part, there's one thing going on and we each get, you know, a pair of hands and feet to play the game with. So there's the subjective experience, but it's not the totality of who we are. That experience opens us up to a broader caring and a resilience that, again, leaders really can use today, both to see the bigger picture of what they can address, or if they already see it and feel anxious about it, to be restored and resilient in their sense of connectedness, get their feet on the earth.
So tell us a little more specifically about either your books or your programs or people who are interested. What would they get into next? Would they read something you've written? Would they come to your website?
That's such a generous question. Thank you, Susan. Zenleader.global is our website, zenleader.global, and there people can learn about our programs. We have open programs that anyone can come to learn about, learn Zen leadership, where they not only learn the basics of meditation, but the skills of leadership, embodied skills that help them bring that kind of connectedness and skillfulness together in working in their world. So there's Zen Leader programs. We also are planning a summit this spring in perma leadership, which is Zen leadership applied to the climate crisis and applied to how we can face into this time in ways that are more generative and regenerative. So that summit is going to come up around Earth Day next year. So you can stay tuned on that. We can see details of that on our website starting at the beginning of the year. Right now, they can find all of our programs. Now, what happens in a program, most of our programs are online right now. That started during COVID and has continued. So they don't have to travel for them. They can do, but they will find that they are still taking a journey throughout a three-day program where we do physical practices, meditation, as well as different kinds of breathing exercises and Tai Chi kind of movements, energy practices, and then go through these flips of leadership, radical reframes that help people shift out of coping mode into how they can transform, or from or kind of thinking to and kind of thinking, or from blaming things out there to being able to find their power in here, or from trying to control and control situations to how to connect with situations. So there's a whole series of flips on which Zen leadership is founded that we move people through, and they're transformative. These are things that help people be bigger than the challenges they face. So that is all available to people, and I encourage if someone kind of resonates with what they're hearing to check it out at zenleader.global.
Zenleader.global. Thank you for making this so accessible and available to all of us, to anyone who has an inkling that you could be of use in this way. I am sure that I speak correctly for you when I say, yes, you can be of use.
Oh, of course. The human being everyone's got it. That's it.
Everyone. And I find so many people who stop themselves, you know, and they say, well, I'm not good enough, I don't have enough, I don't know enough. And I go, wherever you are right now, it's enough.
Yeah,
and you want more?
Not enough.
You want more?
Yeah.
Look, here it is, right? Do it. And, you know, my granddaughter says, it seems like nobody wants to be the leader. I said, you got it.
leaders are in demand because there's not a lot of people who want to be the leader because leaders often get piled on.
Yeah, they can. They can. Or they don't, or there's a lot of confusion in leadership. I mean, as Joshua Cooper Ramos said some years ago in writing The Seventh Sense, he said, if you are looking around the world and you're not at least a little bit confused, you're not paying attention.
So, right.
It's a confusing job. There's a lot of places of not knowing, and the willingness to hang out there and learn in public, in a sense. You're learning in public. You're and doing the best you can. But that's okay. There's just, you know, we take a very broad definition of leadership as that sincere attempt at expression of the authentic self to add value, to help people, to add value through your authentic self. So getting connected with your authentic self, that's where Zen goes much further than I'll call it conventional leadership development, because it's going to blast through the ego to a fuller sense of who you are.
Real.
And then how you express that. You know, how you express it, that's where your purpose comes through, or what we call, what the conscious mind would call purpose. But what it is that's unique about you that needs, that comes through you. Everyone's got that. So what is that? You know, for each person. It's like we're an antenna, capable of picking up certain signals and transmitting certain signals. And, you know, part of my work with Resonate, you know, one of the books that I wrote, it's how to help people find what they really resonate with and then be able to put that signal into the world. So basically
what you're available to do is to say, what do you resonate with, and here's how you find it, and how can we put it out in the world, and here are some ways to do that. Now, this may be asking the utterly impossible, but can we do any of that in like 5 or 6 minutes?
What part of it would you like to tackle?
I don't know. Maybe personally, I'd like to tackle the last part. Lots of people have good ideas, but it seems hard for them to get them out into the world. Do you find that?
Yeah, let's stick with that, because what I like people to imagine, and you might think about this in your own life, or any of you listening, think about it in your life. What is it you're trying to realize in the world? I mean, picture it. Picture what that success looks like. Is it so important to be able to focus our energy toward what we want, not what we don't want? So what does that look like when that outcome is there? So, for example, I'm planning a summit this April, and I can picture what that summit looks like. I can picture the people it draws together, the threads of learning and inspiration they're getting, the way they connect to each other, projects they could get involved in afterwards. I'm picturing it. And then I come to the next question, which is, who do I have to be in that summit? Who am I in that? What do I have to be doing? What has to be true for me as a leader, for that to be present? Well, there's a lot of relationships I have to form that aren't formed yet, or there's certain connections, there's people I have to talk to, there's a set of things that are different about my day, my habits, my connections and relationships that need to shift. But when I exactly match the genie of that April summit will be now, because I exist in now. And so do you, and so does everyone listening to us right now. So the process of realizing things in the world is a process of personal transformation. You match the future you want. And when you match it, you bring that vision from the future into the present, because that's where you live.
Yes, I also find when I do that, that it's very clear to me what the steps are.
Exactly.
I want to write a new correspondence course, because it seems to me that there's a lot of push out there to get herbalists to be professional, and that's okay. I'm not against that, but I also want to be really clear that you don't have to be professional, that you can just be an herbalist, and you can just treat your family and your friends and help others. Right? You don't have to be a Zen priest to meditate and to help others.
No, that's right. That's right.
right. We can. This is these are things that we can all do. So I said, okay, you know, I'm going to have this course done in this amount of time, and it's going to look like this, and so I need to do this much every day to get there.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can backcast from where it will look like to what needs to happen now, or what has to happen in the next 3 weeks, what has to happen in the 3 days, and you can work backwards.
And then when you get there, you are there because you're always there.
That's right.
As you said.
That's right.
And it's a wonderful feeling. And I also, you know, when I hear you talk, I think about how I read that so many people in the world feel lonely. And it's almost incomprehensible to me. And it's not because I'm surrounded by people. I live alone. But how could you ever feel lonely?
Because one feels separate.
Right. When you know that there is no separation possible.
Well, there's knowing and then there's knowing, right? You know,
right.
You know, so we can tell ourselves, oh, I'm connected, or I know I'm part of something bigger. But if our subjective feeling is I'm so alone, or, you know, nobody understands, or nobody's there, or, you know, I'm in this solitary existence, you know, the feeling of separation can bring out a great deal of loneliness. I mean,
And as you said, that Zen meditation directly counters that and says, choose to be connected.
The connected state, the connected experience arises on its own. So it's not something I may not will it, because the I that would want it is what disappears. You know, so it's not.
That's for sure.
But you
still have to make a place that it would be happy to live.
There you go. You create the conditions. You make a place where it's happy to live, and it moves in.
It moves in, right. Well, I so enjoy speaking with you, and we're coming close to the end of our time. So is there anything that you wanted to talk about that you haven't had an opportunity to talk about yet? Let's get that in.
Well, you know, what I might just offer, even for anyone listening right now, just as a simple practice that can help address some of that anxiety or aloneness or how do I get startedness or anything, a simple grounding practice.
Is
just to, as you hear the, you know, our talking even now, letting out a long, slow exhale, just letting out a long exhale that could just like drain down to the earth as if you were like conducting, you know, rain from a rain gutter right down into the earth, just a long, slow exhale. And if you can feel your feet in the earth, even better. Your big toes connect to the earth, even better. A sense of rootedness in the earth, even better. And just let everything settle down. And in that settling down, notice what starts to shift in your experience. Just notice what starts to happen. And you could splurge and take another breath and let this exhale come even slower. And what you might notice is little parts in the body that want to adjust a little bit to let the breath slow down or to untense so the breath can settle. And that's good. Just let those things settle. And maybe even a third breath that's even slower. And you can hear in my voice as I'm slowing down my own breath how we settle down, how in that settling down, calming down, we get into a state where even the rate of thought starts to slow down. And in our busy lives, this slowing down can be so useful for a refresh, a restore, and being able to take things as they come with a kind of resilience. So I would just offer, if you have time for nothing else, remember you're always breathing, so why not do it right? And that's a nice, long, slow exhale that helps you just settle down and relax when you need that kind of grounding.
Thank you. And I am so happy that more and more people are starting to understand that if someone is upset, take a deep breath is the wrong way.
Yeah, upset is already high. And
already breathing too much in. Do not take another deep breath. Breathe out. Breathe out. Let it go.
Let it go. Let it go. Yeah. Yeah. In Aikido, we say relax completely. To do such useful advice of relax doesn't mean like a couch potato relax. It means help the tension ease out of your body. And a great way to do that is with this long exhale, you're really stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system and helping the body relax. And the deeper you relax, the deeper you can breathe. So,
yes, and it does great things for the vagus nerve too.
Well, that's it, you know, because you're breathing down into the lower abdomen.
Yeah, right down in there.
Yeah. And when that starts regulating the breath, everything changes. That's what we're doing in Zazen with every breath, in Zen meditation. Every breath is that kind of deep, hara-regulated breathing. Yeah. So, wonderful to speak with you.
I believe that what we're doing is to reweave the healing cloak of the ancients. 86 generations have been woven in tonight. What a massive reweaving of ancients into this cloak. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Jeannie Whitelaw. And tell us that website one more time.
Thank you. Zenleader.global.
Zenleader.global. And Sarah Ellen, thank you for helping me restore herbal medicine to its rightful place as people's medicine. Green blessings, everyone. Talk to you next week. Good night.
Good night.